Welcome back to University of Minnesota Extension's Nutrient Management Podcast. I'm Jack Wilcox in the communication side of things here in Nutrient Management. Today we're going to talk about state phosphorus guidelines throughout the Midwest. What are they now and what makes them so important for growers? We have four experts on phosphorus guidelines here with us today. Can you each please introduce yourselves?
This is Daniel Kaiser. I'm with the University of Minnesota Department of Soil, Water, and Climate. I've been working on phosphorus guidelines in Minnesota for the better part of the last 17 years. Here, I'm located at the St. Paul campus.
I am Antonio Manarino. I am at Iowa State, and I have been here for about 35 years with a research and extension appointment, focusing essentially in most things about fertility except nitrogen.
I'm John Jones. I'm a soil fertility extension specialist with the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. I've worked on phosphorus research related to agronomic crop production in Wisconsin for the last 3 years, and now have recently moved to Illinois and will be doing very similar work in the state of Illinois as well.
I'm Dorival Ruiz Diaz, soil fertility specialist at Kansas State University. And I've also been working on fertilizer recommendations, specifically including phosphorus for the last 16 or 17 years here in Kansas.
Let's have everybody begin by describing their current state phosphorus fertilizer guidelines, and then maybe some history for context. Dan, why don't we begin with you in Minnesota?
So Minnesota is kind of interesting just because we're kind of at a crossroads here. If you look at our soils, we've got the western part of the state, a lot of the stuff, we've got soils similar to the Great Plains versus you go to the east and south where we're more similar to the kind of central corn belt. And the guidelines, though, if you look at Minnesota, have been more conservative than many of the other states around us. And the focus has been on what we call the sufficiency approach, which essentially is only applying the fertilizer that's needed to maintain maximum yield. And there's been a lot of criticism on that, just mainly because of many growers looking at focusing on something more that we'd see at some of the other states, more of a maintenance style strategy. So it's one of the things that in starting in Minnesota, I've been kind of working towards at least providing some grower flexibility. And we have changed some of our guidelines as we've gone along. And I think a lot of the really emphasis is you start getting closer to the Iowa border. We've got a fair number of consultants or growers that are working across the border. So you're looking at both sets of recommendations. And I think that's kind of the emphasis really of this podcast, is talking a little bit more about this, because, you know, we see these state borders, we see soils that extend across state lines, and there's always a lot of questions on that. And if you look at the guidelines, the main challenge for some of us has been trying to figure out where some of those guidelines have come from. And for, you know, me, being that my predecessor had a pretty strong relationship in Nebraska, it's where we brought a lot of the Western, well, the sufficiency approach into Minnesota with the recommendations. So that's kind of where we're sitting now, although I've been working with a number of things here in the state just to look at gathering more trial information and looking at regionally, just more interest in looking at some of our, what we're doing potentially regionally for comparing some of our guidelines across state lines.
Since about 2002, we have interpretations for the Bray 1, for the Olsen, for the Melick 3 colorimetric, and for the Melick 3 ICB. Okay, those are the interpretations that we have, and the Melick 3 ICB are a bit higher than the numbers. So we essentially tell the people very clearly that they need to input that, not the yield goal, the prevailing yield in order to estimate the removal. But of course, we have some defaults that every 5, 6, 7 years, we update those defaults because some labs tell us that many farmers, they don't put the yield, so they need that to put in there. Then we have the high that we define as having about 5% probability response or less, where we recommend only starter phosphorus in some condition. And then we have the very high that we recommend nothing. Okay, so this is the key. So essentially we say, well, in the very low, there is at least at about 80% probability response. For the low, about 55. The optimum, about 25. 5 for the high, and essentially less than 1 or less for the very high.
The history behind Wisconsin phosphorus recommendations for both grain crops and forage crops is not too dissimilar to most other states, where kind of a rich history of field research had been done to support those predictions of a crop response to peat fertilization, and that was indicated via soil test phosphorus. So any kind of current status of recommendations within Wisconsin, there's really two delineations that make up the interpretation of a soil test. And that is the soil group or the specific type of soil that the farmer will be working and sending a soil sample in. Those are usually broken down into loamy and then sandy and organic pairings, essentially. So really two categories. But then also there's crop demand levels. And those demand levels are really based off of the amount of removal that would come off of that specific field with the harvested portion of the crop.
In the case of Kansas, for us, thinking a little bit or general guidelines and what is the history behind that, the guideline for us is really really have two different types of recommendation, if you will. One is the strictly sufficiency approach. And we do have an alternative, which is a build and maintain. So essentially that provides flexibility for the producer to basically use either one. And so that, again, in some ways, maybe similar to what Dan mentioned earlier, the context of why we have these is because in Kansas, if you think about the gradient going from east to west, the eastern side of the state with a little bit more like the Corn Belt, but very quickly you get central and west is really the Great Plains, where limiting factor tends to be more precipitation, and that's really our main limitation. So a lot of our farmers, especially dryland farmers out west, they will typically like to build that soil test a little bit more and at least take care of that fertility. And then hopefully, you know, when you get that rain, they're going to have good yields, right? And so they don't want to have that as a limiting factor. So I will say that's a little bit of the context of why we move to this approach of providing both options to farmers. There are also obviously the issue of tight budgets and you know, cost of fertilizer and grain prices. Like again today, where unfortunately the grain prices are going down and starting to get some of that question. And in that situation, you know, a sufficiency approach is usually a better option for that farmer, where we're really not trying to build up or put in additional phosphorus fertilizer. We really just want to maximize or optimize yield for that particular crop. And again, our recommendation provides that flexibility. And so that's a little bit of our approach. I would say both are used quite a bit, and it really depends on where you are in the state and the philosophy that each farmer has. And that's a little bit of the context. In terms of what is the soil test that we use, historically has been Bray, but you know, over the years and with more data, of course, we find that Bray has some limitations, especially in our high pH soils. And so we move quite a bit more to Melic 3 in recent years. That's been really more of the default that we try to use. And Olsen as well, which is one that's very commonly used in the western part of the state. With the use of ICP as well, we are working to develop interpretations similar to what Iowa has, essentially provide the flexibility for the producer and having all the different soil test methods, Melic 3, colorimetric, ICP, as well as Olsen and Bray for the farmer to use those different interpretations. So that's the direction we are moving in terms of the soil test methods that we have.
From a regional standpoint, are today's state guidelines satisfactory?
Well, one of the questions I think is something, I mean, you look at all of us talking about the recommendations, you look at the differences across state lines in terms of interpretation, it becomes a little bit confusing. And I think Antonio hit the nail on the head with some of what he was talking about is, you know, being more straightforward in terms of what we mean with our guidelines. I mean, I think all of our states have five ranges that we use for separating out the different sufficiency levels or the ability of the soil to supply phosphorus, but the interpretations and, you know, some of the history behind those interpretations differ from state to state. And it does become an issue when you start looking at across or larger areas that, you know, combining data sets, it becomes a problem because for one, looking at Minnesota, we recommend the Bray and the Olsen, like many of the other states, but a lot of labs are starting to use the Malik 3 test. And with phosphorus, the thing to remember is we can't use the interpretations from one test to the other always. I mean, you essentially looking at different interpretations for different tests. And that becomes a problem with if you're looking at more of a regional type approach to recommendations. So then it kind of comes to us in terms of looking at what are some of the fundamental things we can look at for a soil test that gives us some of the key information that we might need for making decisions to kind of look at comparing things from state to state. I mean, I think that a couple of really key pieces now, and it's one thing that we've been providing more, has been the probability and magnitude of response for the given soil test class. So I give kind of an idea to growers on what they might be looking at for a return on investment. But it also, I think, helps we start looking at comparing across states because that information is a bit more, I think, comparable versus some of the interpretations. And I think that's what a lot of people want in terms of looking at the data. They want the ability to make the decision themselves, but have some of the key pieces of information out there to help them make those decisions. I mean, I hope they're taking soil tests. I mean, that's, you know, something that we see some growers go to more a maintenance style approach, but then kind of forget about the soil testing, which, you know, that is hard when you get the questions, when we start seeing these imbalances between with high fertilizer prices and low commodity prices, is those questions on, you know, how do I make ends meet in these situations? And really soil tests is kind of the key thing. So that's a good starting point. And then just looking at what information is out there to help you kind of interpret things to get the best, to make the best decision in economically. I mean, I was at a meeting recently and there were two growers there, and it's interesting. You had an old grower or an old farmer that had been farming for a number of years that says inputs makes yield. So you wouldn't cut back on any inputs. Then you got the young guy sitting there saying, you know, like the commodity prices are bad and, you know, I can't really afford anything. So how do I make this work? And that's kind of the thing is, you know, really, I think the growers, when it comes to their goals, is really key when it comes to providing information to them and just making sure we have the information that, that can answer some of their questions.
On the subject of profits and yields and cash flow, when finances are tight, do some farmers forego taking a soil test? Or do farmers prioritize soil tests even through financially lean situations?
I could throw that out to the group, but the thing about soil testing, if you look at price changes, I mean, yeah, it tends to increase over time, but it isn't as volatile as some of the commodity and the fertilizer prices. So to me, I mean, it makes sense, you know, something where even if you're not taking some very intense grids, to at least have some information to go by is I think really important on that end. So I can kind of let that up to the group too, if anybody else wants to touch on that one.
Yes, I completely agree with that. And this is something I try to emphasize, you know, and I hear this often. I see some people always say, you know, budget's pretty tight, so I'm not going to soil sample. Well, that's the wrong place to cut on expenses. I mean, that's the value of having that soil test information is much more when you have tight budgets, because you may have opportunities to save money on fertilizer, when in other cases, maybe you have opportunities to, you know, capture a little bit of yield and make profit. So this is very important, and I think something definitely to emphasize with the conditions we have this year.
Yeah, I agree with what Dan and Toriver say. You know, we have about similar situation in Iowa. There are many, a large area of manure soils with phosphorus is sky high. It's not so high as in some states of the East that they have these problems, but it is very high. So, of course, all of us have our different philosophies for approaching extension, you know, and outreach, but I have been trying for the last 20 years to show in every single of my articles or talks the economic returns from fertilization, you know. So they see that, hey, if you have low testing soils, you have to be sure, you know, that you have the right amount of phosphorus there. Don't reduce, don't cut. Even people that are renting, as long as they are sure that they will have that field one more year, they should apply. Don't cut. You will get your money back. There is a very high probability of economic response. Now, you are in the high or very high. Hey, as long as you have a good soil test plan or soil test sampling approach that you can trust it, you should not apply one atom of phosphorus in very high testing soils, other than maybe starter in some conditions. So this is our current struggle. You know, actually, it has been for many years. And we have not been doing surveys random, but the last kind of random survey that we did about 12 years ago over 33 counties was about two-thirds of the Iowa field tested optimal high or very high. We have some spots, of course, in every field. That's why I am this maniac in this north central region that I encourage grid sampling, a variable rate application. We have some spots. And then southern Iowa, we do have some soils that are low and they just don't apply. But the main issue is the people need to understand that they are not making as much money as they could in those high testing soils.
Well, I think a lot of the contemporary issues that were brought up are ubiquitous in Wisconsin as well. As Antonio said, manure is kind of the monkey on everyone's back in terms of needing to make sure that we don't excessively build up P. I know some of the more recent research I've done in the last few years in Wisconsin related to the state guidelines has confirmed that the philosophy works pretty well. Adjustments were needed to be made to interpretation ranges, but there are some big cropping system changes that occur around the state that I think are changing sometimes the way we have to think about some of the interpretations and really just kind of the boots on the ground agronomics. So our crop rotations are getting shorter. There's much less crop rotations in Wisconsin, for example, with alfalfa in the rotations. The dairy sector is getting more aggregated and less spatially distributed across the state. And so that means there's fewer farms receiving manure, but certainly the same amount of cows in the state. And so there's a manure distribution challenge that's always going to occur there. And it's something that we pick up in some of the county level soil test summaries around the state as well. So those are really important things that I think have come up that are related to the recommendations and challenges we face. I think another challenge is simply just trying to have these goals in either reducing high soil test phosphorus fields to meet water quality standards or water quality goals as well. That's something that's been really challenging because honestly, with the variability in soils and crop removal, the rate at which we can draw down some of these high testing soils is very difficult to predict. And so I know that's something that there's ongoing regional work on, but that's a big challenge. And then also, P is really ubiquitous in fertilizer plans around the state, whether it's starter, fall applied MAP and DAP. There's P usually in a starter and a fertilization or fertilizer program that we have to account for. And there's just a lot of different combinations of when it's applied, what the application methods are. That we have to account for, not just for the agronomic, but for the water quality purposes as well. And so those are some kind of challenges that maybe are a little more Wisconsin focused, but relate really well to what Dan, Antonio, and Dorobar just summarized.
We don't have anything until against animal producers. We understand that animal production is extremely important for the economy of our states. And we understand that it's not easy to distribute manure so it really is applied where the phosphorus is low. So we put ourselves in the boots of the farmers or the animal producer. And that's why all of us, the four of us, for a long time have been working with in phosphorus and water quality issues. We have been working with state agencies, we have been working with national groups, all of us. For example, the CETA 17 group, which is a phosphorus environmental, it's an IFA soil test committee. So I just want to make clear that we do understand that farmers sometimes they cannot just take the manure 100 miles, you know, but that's why the four of us had been really working trying to help develop phosphorus index, for example, so they could use that. So they can, you know, if the risk of phosphorus loss is not too high, then they can still apply manure for the nitrogen value, because we need to use the nitrogen in manure. So I just want to say these things to clarify, you know, that, and actually when EPA, as I said, I am the oldest folks here, when in the early 90s EPA wanted to put a threshold with soil test P where farmers could not apply more manure, we, everybody, all the soil fertility people in the United States were against, because each state should have 100 thresholds, because depending on the soil properties, the climate, the rainfall, the production system, all these things, then we have the what is the maximum that's sustainable from the point of view of water quality is different. So I just want to say that the way we were talking about high testing soils in fossil is that some of those farmers that they have high testing soils and they keep applying fertilizer, that's when that could benefit everybody. They could benefit their profits. They could benefit water quality. And that's why continuing research, you know, in soil test calibration, fertilizer recommendations, foremost applications, we have not talked anything about foremost application methods of application, things like that. But so all those things are important in my view.
We're talking about phosphorus fertilizer guidelines almost at a very granular level, like granular by soil type, by location. Having said all that, is it building up to where state phosphorus guidelines might need to be revised in the future? What would that process be, or would you be surprised if they needed adjustment?
Well, I think there's a big push now for some regional work or even national work. This fertilizer FRSTs, fertilizer response support tool, some people may have heard of, that's looking at a national database to try to look at curating some response data that could be queried by individuals if they're looking at more regional response trials. I mean, there are some issues specifically related to what I mentioned before with the soil tests being different, extracting different amounts of phosphorus. For this something like that to work, we all have to have some commonality in terms of what we do. So the same sampling depth, it's the same, again, methodology for soil tests. So that's, I think, one of the major challenges. I think in the north central region, we're pretty close. I mean, the only one save, I think, is Wisconsin's potassium, although I think they're moving maybe from the Bray. I don't know. That I think that's one of the main challenges, you know, with AI and with some of the modeling we can do right now. I mean, certainly we can handle larger data sets. The thing, though, I want people to know is that you're not going to find data that's in your every single county across every single state. And I think that's the challenge, because when it comes to looking at something more regionalized or something where we need large data sets, you need a lot of data to do that. And, you know, with phosphorus, that's one of the things I do see, at least for us in Minnesota, is that if you look at things like the probability that you're going to get a response at a given soil test, it doesn't necessarily change all that much given some of the differences in soil properties. So these are the things that I think need to be looked at in the future on a larger scale, just to kind of see, because I think there's a lot we can do by consolidating some of the data in the region. I think that's generally kind of what we're looking forward, but we're still looking at, I think in most cases, states having their own recommendations, but I mean, at least being able to be more upfront with growers in terms of terminology and things that we commonly use in some of our recommendations, I think it's really going to be key on that in terms of interpreting some of that. So I think that's really the thing moving forward is, you know, we're looking at more regional work, which I think is good, more focused on phosphorus, because that hasn't always necessarily been the case. And that's why the four of us are on here, because we're the four in the region that have a lot of work on phosphorus, but isn't the case across some of the states. And so that's kind of the main thing, is we just need to kind of keep pushing forward, getting some trials in place, and then, but also not forgetting the fact that there's a lot of data out there that could be, you know, potentially used. So there's a fair amount we can do. And I think there's some things that I think people are going to see moving forward, but just don't think that we're going to have a response trial in every county in every state. It just doesn't happen. I mean, you're looking at drawing data. You're going to need to draw data from a wider scale still, even if you're looking at some more localized recommendations with some of the things that are in place right now, particularly with something like the first tool that is just kind of in its infancy in terms of release.
Just to follow up on that, and I agree, I think there are great opportunities for more regional approach. But I think the key here is really looking at regional and look at common soil types and conditions and crops, but also without ignoring the difference that we have in soil types and soil test methods that we need to use. I think that those are the key aspects. Again, we mentioned earlier, for example, the Bray is something that's very common, you know, in Illinois. And Indiana and other places works well, but you know, we may have some issues in as we go west in higher pH soils and that type of aspect that we need to keep in mind. So there's still going to be, ideally, in my opinion, some level of specificity for, you know, what works best in that specific soil type and condition. So that's something that we need to keep in mind. Obviously, leveraging all the, you know, more data that we have out there, also that's an opportunity. For us in Kansas, on the question of the guidelines today, and I feel like we do have also some challenges. Specifically, one of them is looking at some of the soil test methods. We have commercial labs that are you know, using soil test methods that maybe have not been necessarily calibrated with data in the field, and that's something that we need to be looking at. I think there are potentially some methods that maybe you know, we need to develop more data, and that's okay. That's one thing that we're always trying to look and pay attention to, that working with our colleagues in commercial labs. I like something that Dan mentioned earlier in terms of looking a little bit more in the context of probability and magnitude of response, which is something that we need to do more of that as well in our case, and tie that to the economics. You know, we've done a very good job in nitrogen to do the, you know, the economic optimal nitrogen rate and so on, but very little in for phosphorus, except for Antonio. He's done a lot of that aspect. But again, this is something that we need to continue to do that. In our case, in the case of people using the build and maintain approach, for example, a few years ago with a high price of fertilizer, they were able to cut back on phosphorus fertilizer and use some of that extra phosphorus that's there, which is something that's also an opportunity for those using manure, for example, right? There's an opportunity there, and goes back to what we discussed earlier, using soil tests, you know, fertilizer prices are high or grain prices are low. Hey, we can come back on rates, and that's okay, you know, as long as we have that information. And so those are some of the key aspects that for us, I think is still important to continue to develop, and definitely some challenges there and great opportunities as well, especially working with colleagues in the region.
Dorivar, those are key issues that we've done too. Now, the other thing that we need to understand, the farmers and consultants and scientists needs to understand, that soil fertility and soil test calibration and soil chemistry, those may be exact sciences, but nutrient management at a practical level is not. There is much of economic concepts, risk management, things like that, you know. So we can all agree and come in with an equation, how to calculate the critical level, you know, whatever, for the Bray, blah, blah, blah. And really, that's not very important, you know. We can show that. We have been showing that for 50 years. Farmer consultants, companies know that. The key issue is, what do we do? So how we can provide interpretations and suggestions and guidelines so that the consultants and the farmers can say, okay, that's great, but this is my philosophy. This is what I would like to do, you know. And I remember when in Kansas, Dale Lakem, many years ago, he was the one that first introduced this dual recommendations approach, the strict sufficiency level and the build-up and maintenance. I defended it, and I was, you had no idea. Everybody wanted to shot us, you know, our colleagues in soil fertility. I wanted to do the same thing in Iowa, and I could not convince my peers. No, what you are doing is to essentially let the farmer do whatever they want. Well, come on, they will do whatever they want anyway. unless there is regulation that all of us oppose, you know, as much as possible. So, but I believe then that in addition to all the things that we talk about, and I agree 100%, a couple of years ago, we started a project with Dan and Oliver to really build on that, but also include this idea, how do we explain what our recommendations are, how people can interpret in different ways, and to show that there are no 4 R's. When my friend Paul Fixen started talking about the 4 R's years ago, I said, come on, Paul, there are no 4 R's. There are 100 R's, because that depends on the situation, the farmer, and the philosophy of management and the attitude toward risk. So I believe that that is something that we can do in our interpretation recommendation. If we could, it's not easy, if we could somehow make clear, listen, this is our philosophy for the recommendation, you know, but look at these points, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you could adapt this to your particular philosophy and concerning risk of investment of fertilizer or manure application. Now, this is very difficult, okay? But I think that we need to start talking about it, and we are trying. We are trying. Actually, Dan and others, we have started inviting each other to our stage to speak, you know, and so we need to start talking about things, but it's not easy. It's not easy.
Is there a piece of guidance or advice pertaining to phosphorus guidelines in your state that you might want to offer growers?
Well, I think one of the things I just go with is the fact that if we look at phosphorus, I mean, even with the differences we have across state lines, it's still, when it comes to soil testing, to me, one of the easiest ones to assess with the soil test versus potassium. So that's one of the things that, looking at costs, to me, it's one of the ones, if you have the soil test value, you can pretty easily make a decision of whether you need it or not. So, you know, that's one of the things I've been really preaching to a lot of growers as they start talking about economics, is that, you know, phosphorus, the data is pretty solid compared to some of the other nutrients we're looking at.
I think that, yeah, I agree. Now, one thing that I believe has been useful in our state is that, until now at least, is that we had been very good communication between the university, the researchers, the applied fertility researcher and extension, with the state agencies in charge of nutrient management, like NRCS or DNR. So and even companies, and for example, the IBB Association of Iowa, you see, even though we have our differences, there have been talks about it, and all of this group had been a participant of what we call the nutrient reduction strategy, you know, that actually the name should be nutrient export reduction strategy, you know. And so we have been start working with that about a few years ago. And I believe that that's very positive, because I believe that we're going to get not just the farmers, but the consultants, the companies, the agribusiness, and the public to understand the complex issues around nutrient management. You see, all these problems. We need to understand each other. We need to understand these different views. So that way we can collaborate, you know, and we can get to something good for everybody.
Well, I think with one of the biggest challenges in Wisconsin is working with soil variability across given fields. And working in the state, there's no better place for intensive soil sampling and zone or grid management to work, because of the changes in even soil order, so parent material and soil texture within one field. And so really trying to capture that variability generally has benefits, not just agronomically and for nutrient loss, but also for your pocketbook. I think that's really important. And finally, when a lot of the guidelines around manure application are based on how fast you can reduce high testing soils, one of the important things is to make sure that you're optimizing, whether it's corn silage, corn or soybean grain or alfalfa, or even an alternative forage, maximizing and optimizing those yields to remove phosphorus even faster from high testing soils. And so you can have just as effective, essentially freedom to operate, so to speak. We've seen interactions between potassium nutrition and phosphorus removal in corn silage. And that if you don't have your potassium nutrition at least at a sufficient level, your ability to, not just your silage yield, but your ability to remove phosphorus and potentially draw down your soil test level will be reduced. And so it's really, it's a complex system where a lot of these nutrients interact with each other. And so I think that's really important, is to not just focus on that, because in, at the end of the day, most likely your fertilizer program has multiple nutrients in it. You're looking at your soil test data where you're trying to capture what's going on across your whole field. Look at the whole picture, and then probably your phosphorus management might be a little more simple.
Yes, in some ways I agree with what others already say. I really want to emphasize in cases like cassava, for example, we do have a much diverse crop cropping systems, and so keep that in mind. How the different crops differ in terms of a phosphorus response and needs. We need to be specific to that. I think there are great opportunities to improve not just agronomics but also water quality as we think more about placement, and can we do a better job there. Oftentimes a lot of the benefits have to be more on the water quality, which is something that we need to keep an eye on. And the other thing too that John just mentioned, I think, is and some that we do see in Kansas quite a bit, is what else is limiting factor? I mean, we talk about phosphorus today, but what about pH? What about other nutrients, and making sure we maximize the use of that phosphorus we apply? That's something that we tend to see oftentimes. You know, we think a lot about some of the nutrients, but what about some of the basics, such as pH, for example? So things to think about.
Before we go, if you have a question or comment for one of our guests or a topic you'd like discussed in a future episode, please email us at nutmgmt@umn.edu. Thanks, and we look forward to hearing from you. All right, that about does it for this episode of the Nutrient Management Podcast. We'd like to thank the Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council, or AFRIC, for supporting the podcast. Thanks for listening.